You're listening to Talking Pictures with the multifaceted film historian, lead film festival writer for Influx Magazine, multi-award-winning producer of feature films and shorts, your host, Mr. Paul Booth.
Hello. Welcome. Aloha. It is Paul Booth. Thank you for joining us today. We are so happy to have you here as listeners and supporters. We want to thank all our guests, past and present. I always like to send my thanks out to our audio team and our co-producers and everyone that helps put together these shows for you guys. Had a great time last night at the ASC Awards. Wanted to thank Richard Crudo, the president of ASC. It was a wonderful time. I'm not going to spoil who took home the award, because that's usually a predictor many times of who wins the Cinematography Award. So we'll still leave some suspense for Sunday. Today we are celebrating Oscar Month, of course, since it's February. We're going to be having a guest today, Ronna Joy Glickman, who produced a wonderful, just this awesome behind-the-scenes documentary that was back in, I should have checked the specific year, if it was 97, 98, something like that. It was called Full Tilt Boogie, and it was about From Dusk Till Dawn, great horror movie that Quentin Tarantino made with Robert Rodriguez and Juliette Lewis, and of course it was one of George Clooney's first films before he was George Clooney, and I say that with respect, but there was difference between George Clooney and George Clooney. Nice guy, wonderful guy, came and did work on Kauai. Usually what I do when I start out by giving you guys some recommendations, today I'm just going to throw some quick ones out there that are on Netflix. I'm in a Cameron Crowe mood, so you need to get on there and check out Jerry Maguire. I know I've recommended that one before, but all that does is tell you what a great movie it is and how you need to check it out. Almost Famous. I suggest trying to find a library that has the two disc of this so you can find the bootleg director's cut. It is much better than the regular film, even though there's just some simple additions. If you've ever traveled or you love music or have ever been to some great shows, you pick up on a lot of different things. Also, Vanilla Sky is another one you can check out. Speaking of that, last night at the ASC Awards, they gave the Lifetime Achievement Award, President's Award, to Matthew F. Leonetti, who shot Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which Cameron Crowe wrote. Again, he did not direct it. That was Amy Heckerling. But that was a movie, I think, that we all know, we all relate to, one of the great 80s movies, teen comedies. Of course, Crowe always sets the bar with his writing for the genre and what he's doing to it, be it the teen movie or Singles or Say Anything. Don't want to get going too long here on Cameron Crowe, because we could talk all day about him. And of course, we're all awaiting his untitled Cameron Crowe project, which is set to come out this summer, filmed in Hawaii. So we're excited about that one, and we're jazzed to be seeing what comes out of Cameron Crowe's mind and vision. Always a good filmmaker. I have my guest calling in. Let me get her on here. Are you there, Ronna?
Hello, Paul.
Hello. Thank you for calling in. We, on behalf of Talking Pictures and our team, we want to thank you for joining us here today and spending your time to talk with us for the listeners. So thank you for that. How are you today?
Having a beautiful morning so far. It's crisp and clear, a lot of wind chimes, no complaints.
Excellent, excellent. Yes, it is beautiful down here in Orange County, too. We will jump right into it here with, I had just given some recommendations, and I'm a big Cameron Crowe freak, so I had told people that they need to get on Netflix and check out Jerry Maguire and Almost Famous, and I don't know what planet they've been living on if they haven't seen Jerry Maguire, but it's always one that I love to watch.
Show me the money.
Yes, yes. Cuba Gooding Jr., and of course, we're celebrating Oscar month. That was an Oscar-winning performance. And Tom Cruise
was nominated
that
year. Oh, my God, and one of the most classic acceptance speeches in the history.
Oh, yes.
Only Roberto Benigni for Life is Beautiful paralleled Cuba Gooding energy.
Yes, yes. And I remember I also enjoyed Matt Damon and Ben Affleck and their and my mom and my everybody in Boston. Yeah, such great speeches. So today we're joined by, do you like to go by Rana Joy or Rana? What do you prefer?
Rana Joy.
Okay, Rana Joy. Okay, so we're joined today by Rana Joy, and like many people, but not to this degree usually, have various experiences in the film business. That's the beauty of the film business, is you get to do a lot of different jobs and work in a lot of different departments and meet a lot of different people. She has worked from production assistant to first AD to UPM to production executive. She's worked with Oscar winners, Graham King. He would be known for The Departed, for those of you that don't go really into deep into producing names. Of course, Quentin Tarantino, which I had mentioned she produced Full Tilt Boogie, and that was a documentary about the film that I said he made with Robert Rodriguez. Of course, George Clooney. She's produced for 10 first-time feature directors, for seasoned directors. She's had work that's been in South by Southwest, Cannes, Berlin, Venice, Toronto, New York, Seattle. Besides some Full Tilt Boogie, some of the films that you can check out are Kicking and Screaming, Real Stories of the Donut Men, Sleep With Me, and Female Perversions.
Female Perversions with Tilda Swinton. Or God
Okay.
Said Ha with Julia Sweeney.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, that sounds really interesting. I don't want to get going down that road.
The road of Tilda Swinton, however, it's a road that I went on a 5-year journey to find her.
Oh, okay, excellent. Well, you know, that's another great thing that we get to speak with you today about, that we want to address, is that, the journey of making a film, and how, one of the things that, spawned us to do this podcast was we really wanted to help audiences understand that when we go and see a film, it wasn't like made last weekend and they shot it in 2 days and wrote the script in 3 days and maybe edited it in a week. It's that sometimes it's been a directors like Gangs of New York, a classic example, how we were speaking about that yesterday, how Scorsese has an idea for a couple of decades, and longer than some people have even been alive. So with that, because I know, of course, talking film can always go in so many different directions, what I would like to do is discuss with some of your background, if you could kind of tell us what some of your favorite parts are, or some of your favorite, jobs that you've had or projects that you've had. We can kind of go from there, and then Let it roll on.
Right on, Paul. I'll give a jump in on that. As you mentioned, it all started for me with being a great production assistant. There were two things that I already knew how to do before I became a proverbial member of the filmmaking tribe. I grew up an equestrian, and I knew how to ride horses, and I had also been a waitress, so I knew how to be of service. I knew how to clean up and show up, and I rode my way into the film business. My early gigs were as an equestrian stunt woman, and that led eventually to PAing work. My very first job that my friend, my dear friend Jeremy Gardner, got me my first paying production gig on a Diet Coke commercial. It was actually a series of Diet Coke commercials with great athletes promoting the project, and I got paid while Sugar Ray Leonard said, "They call me sugar-free," about 100 times that day. And it was at a boxing ring out in Van Nuys. And I just loved watching each of the different departments and the each area of specialization come to life. I remember being particularly fascinated by the dolly grip, because the grip department, which handles obviously the heavy hardware in conjunction with the electric department, and collectively they're underneath the cinematographer as dealing with all of the lighting. The grips are so elegant to me. They're like it's like a choreographed dance, like a ballerina, the way a beautiful dolly grip moves through space. And the next day of that commercial shoot was Wayne Gretzky, and we were shooting at an ice rink down in Culver City. And I got, because I happen to have grown up on the East Coast and I know how to ice skate, I got to ice skate back and forth, bringing Mr. Gretzky water. And I was forever more hooked. I loved the tribal community unity of a crew.
Yes, yes.
So that's really the heart of who I am as a producer starts with the heart of who I was as a PA, as a production assistant.
You know, I like that you're saying that, because I would say that 90% of our guests so far, and I believe this is our 12th show, has said that their favorite thing is the community and the family-like atmosphere and the way we've discussed that. You know, Ronna Joy was saying that she was working on Diet Coke commercial, and for those of you that don't know the film business, PA is, you know, pretty much the low gig, and to be doing something that interacts with Wayne Gretzky, but that just happens when you're a PA, and that is something that I don't believe you could, like, be at a business convention and get to talk with Donald Trump, or just get to immediately meet somebody that's, you know, the head of their world. And so it's really cool that you hit on that, because I think that's that community part is the best part of the film business, and I really see how you really captured that in Full Tilt Boogie. So was that like, did you
I'm so glad you just connected the spirit of that macroscopic, yet, you know, that snapshot view of community and tribe, because for me, making Full Tilt Boogie, which, you know, again, is a documentary film that was shot on the set of From Dusk Till Dawn, it was such fun being able to give as much credence to the craft service person and the grip department and the ADs as we gave screen time and honor to George Clooney and Juliette Lewis and, of course, Smokey Muppetino, as I like to call him, Quentin. It was such a celebration of that camaraderie and that spirit. I mean, we had such a good time shooting those movies, and that was almost like if you picture soldiers in the military and, you know, the dark side of being so vulnerable or being a soldier. That particular film was almost like the sun moon, the yin yang, the joyous side of being a tribe or a group, and there were a lot of hurdles to surmount. And although Full Tilt Boogie certainly captures the playful element, there was a lot on the line. We were fighting for changes in union contracts, and That was and continues. You know, it was a very serious matter.
Yeah, there's some interesting. For those of you that haven't seen the movie, you can, I would say, watch it right now. But I want you to finish listening to the show. So, in about 32 minutes, you can click over to Netflix, and it is on Netflix, and it does have a 5-star rating, which there are very few films. We're talking Wolf of Wall Street has 5 stars. This is a documentary again, From Dusk Till Dawn. I do believe, actually, Nothing Against the Film or the People does have, I think it's a 3.5 or a 4-star rating. But this for anybody that loves documentaries, it's just fun, and you get to see a different side of Juliette Lewis, and you get to see, like, the way you guys captured crowds. And there's just some really great stories. And I think what you also captured so well in this film was that as much as I want this show to also be for people, not just people that work in the film business, but to see how these are all just regular people. There's some, like, the all I'll leave it as is there's a great
the transportation drivers.
Yeah, the drivers, and there's a great beer story with Quentin Tarantino and the Grips, and it just shows you that they're sitting around and they're having the same things and the same that we have. And to give a context to the movie that I think you could best explain it, since you were there and involved with it, I always like to make sure that the listeners have a exact context what we're talking of. Was that this was not now Quentin Tarantino of Django or Inglourious Basterds or the way the industry has changed. This was Quentin when it was, some called it Quentin Mania. So how could you kind of, you know, share with us what it was like to be in that realm of time that was?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that Quentin Tarantino is a beautiful human being, and his passion is so pure for storytelling and for the movie that he's making that it's just a magical experience to be in his presence. I actually met Quentin back when Reservoir Dogs was coming together. A girlfriend of mine was the first AD on Reservoir Dogs, and Quentin's line producer, Paul Hellerman, who's a very dear old friend of mine, you know, they were just ambitiously trying to get the film delivered for a certain number. And when I first met Quentin himself, was while I was shooting a film called Sleep With Me, and Quentin came to be an actor in the film for a day, and he had a really good time working on our set, and we really enjoyed working with him, and a lot of our crew got to then go on and work on Pulp Fiction with him, which was, of course, history in the making, but the wonderful thing about history and being a part of something as culturally anomalous as Quentin's camp is that you really don't understand the gravitas or the impact of it until you're looking back in time, looking, you know, retrospectively at what it was that you were actually a part of. I mean, I remember at one point I had been working with Quentin for a couple of years, and I was in the UK, not in the UK, I was in Ireland, and I was location scouting for a film that I very much wanted Tilda Swinton to be in. And I was in this remote village in Ireland that had one pub, and someone in the town found out through someone else that I worked with Quentin. And that evening, when my colleagues, my mates, and I went by the pub to get a bite to eat, the whole place was packed, jam-packed, with people who just wanted to meet me to ask questions about Quentin. And then after that trip, I remember I had a couple of meetings in London, and I went to London, and I saw the Pulp Fiction paraphernalia, posters, art. It had taken over the town like propaganda, and I think that at that point in time, I really started to understand just how much his destiny was a force of nature and a global one at that. So the context is difficult to convey. To me, he is an old dear friend. He's categorically a genius and one of the most passionate people that I've worked with in general, one of the most passionate people I've ever met in my life, let alone in film. But the context is that, you know, we were all indie cowboy kids, and we were all very determined to deliver things with the vision that we had for each individual picture. And Quentin and I have that in common, and we're purists to the story that we're telling. I also want to mention that my beloved director of Full Tilt Boogie is the lovely Sarah Kelly, who had also been a PA, production assistant, on several independent films. And Eric Stoltz actually is the one who asked me to hire Sarah Kelly on Sleep With Me. And Sarah was a PA on Pulp Fiction, and then Quentin and Sarah and I ended up making the documentary Full Tilt Boogie. So the context is personal. Sorry about my barking dog.
No worries.
Hello,
no
Sinclair
worries.
Angus. So the context was both, it was magical, it was personal, it was just a bunch of friends trying to do a couple of cool things together. And, you know, clearly it turned into a world movement of sorts in terms of his work. And he's gone on to make pictures that I think are, you know, hugely socially important, like Inglourious Basterds. And I'm saying that as a Jewish Indian. I was really glad that Quentin got to make Inglourious Basterds, because I remember when that was just a concept, and it's a powerful picture, and it's just powerful. It's a privilege to have been a part of all of this history. It's so rich, and, you know, I got to learn and be mentored by masters. So I was and am a lucky dog.
Oh, yes. I mean, and we really appreciate that, because as we had discussed yesterday, Tarantino, I was in film school, and of course Pulp Fiction came out when I was just a teenager, and so I didn't have the place to put on it. I didn't have his love for Hawks and his love for Godard and his love for De Palma and his love for every old director, and so there would be these great film school debates that we would have, and I'm sure a lot of my film school buddies who listen to this are going to remember this, is that we had a lot of guys who didn't have a context that Tarantino loved old cinema, and they would refuse to watch old cinema but would watch Reservoir Dogs and would praise something in Pulp Fiction that was just, you know, blatantly used from a director that he loved, or something that he will say in a book he did like Hawks. And so for me, what was really interesting about Quentin Tarantino was it was the first time where I saw a film director who was willing to say, I love this director, I did not invent this, you know. And once in a while you'll hear George Lucas say, oh, you know, Empire Strikes Back is like Flash Gordon. And there's a great quote. I actually read it in that Quentin Tarantino book, the interviews series, where they say there's two types of people that think film died with Godard and started with Star Wars. And so I've always appreciated that directors like Tarantino and so many others, Scorsese, like you were saying, and people like yourself that are purists, that also protect the story and the art, that do acknowledge that there's directors before them, and that, you know, whatever happens with the project, like you're saying, no matter how global it gets, that you still know there's directors that came before you
I think that ultimately we're talking about honoring history and some regards honoring our ancestors. And, you know, I just wanted to share on a personal note, my father, who's retired now, but he's a professor of international relations, and he's a very academic man. And my father and I share in common the love for reading biographies and autobiographies. And we love history. And I always think it always delights me when we see a character in a film who is portraying an American president, not to make it exclusively American, but that's the example that came to mind. And we tend to reveal those American president characters as characters who know the track record and voting record and key decision-making points of the administrations and the presidents that have preceded them. In that way, Quentin Tarantino is merely and hugely presidential. He honors his influences, his ancestors, and a way in which I think that he and I, mind you, I relate to him profoundly in this way, because my father is from India and my mother is a Jewish artist from the Bronx. And so my heritage is very diversified, and as a result of that, I like to respect my ancestors. I like to respect the lessons from the Indian side of my family and from the Jewish side of my family. And Quentin is doing the same thing when he makes movies. He's respecting the ancestry of his passion. And so it is completely logical really what he is a man of integrity. And I'm sure if he was a doctor or an engineer or an architect, he would be the same way, because he appreciates that nothing is done by oneself other than the actual channeling and protecting and guiding and polishing, and that ultimately, you know, it's hard work. And I do not know film history with the kind of sophistication that you do or that Quentin Tarantino does, but I honor my ancestors in leadership and in humanity by way of my own career. You mentioned earlier, when we were talking about production assistants and a PA, and you said, and I didn't interrupt you, but I'd love to circle back to it now. You said it was a low job. And I know what you meant was that it's, you know, technically it is the lowest position on the food chain. But I think what you were trying to say, Paul, when you were talking about how I got to ice skate and hang out with Wayne Gretzky, that we as a tribal community are circular, not linear. And therefore, the bottom touches the top. The shark, you know, the whale eats the plankton. And because of that, and Quentin and I are very similar in our love of PAs and in our celebration of all rungs of the food chain. But that doesn't only apply to the group that builds and manufactures and creates, you know, builds the miraculous and the impossible in front of the lens. It goes for all of the storytellers and playwrights. I mean, it goes all the way back to Aristophanes, for God's sake. There's, and for me, I have a great deal of respect for the Native American culture, where the stories were passed on by way of the campfire methodology. You know, that was their drive-in movie theater, the campfire. I feel that Scorsese, Spielberg, Redford, Mr. Pollack, may he rest in peace, directors who are open-minded enough and generous enough and absorptive enough actually have the capacity to take in all of their cinematic storytelling ancestry that preceded them. Of course, they're the best filmmakers in the biz, Mr. Eastwood. They've done their homework, and they're not shy to be proud of having done their homework, nor are they too shy or too prideful to admit the source. And that's...
Oh, yes, of course, yes. I mean, yeah, and Eastwood always talking about John Huston, even making that film White Hunter, Black Heart, I believe, where he even played John Huston. I love what you were saying. Yeah, and thank you so much, because what you were mentioning about PA, and that was exactly what I was how I was meaning to word it, because I know my first PA gig, I got to hang out, and right after I tell this, we'll go into For Spacious Sky. It was a reality show, and one of the contestants was on the Denver Broncos, the two teams that won Super Bowls back to back. And he would tell me all these great Super Bowl stories, and he was kind of just indulging me. And then one day he just kind of looked at me and he said, you know, it doesn't matter if you're in the Super Bowl, and it doesn't matter if a million people watch you. He says, I don't wear my Super Bowl rings because people won't stop giving me free stuff. He says, it just matters if you're doing what you love and you're giving it 100%. He said, I'm no better than a janitor right now who's cleaning an elementary school if that's what he loves to do every day. And he goes,
by the way, which harkens to mind the best janitor character was Good Will Hunting.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Of course. Oh, great. Oh, that's great. Yes,
so,
exactly.
You know, case in point, that every human being has a story to tell. Some of us are privileged enough to, and actually have the stamina to make films to bottle those stories. I also direct. I direct documentary. I also write. But my career primarily is as a producer, because for me, the art of producing is in welcoming a symphony of people, all of whom who share that specificity of passion for storytelling in general and the specific craft which they do. So to me, an editor is a filmmaker. A transportation captain is a filmmaker. Oh, my God. You know, the transpo department in our business trumps all. But we'll save that for a different dialogue. I mean, they ultimately... I mean, I always, when I teach film production, I sometimes I'll really just, you know, drop behind the veil. I'll say, listen, did anybody think that the producer, director, and studio were in charge? And, you know, or that the financiers were in charge? And most of the classroom will tend to, you know, raise their hand. Yes, that is perceptually what they think. And I always flip it right on its ear out of the gate. And I say, no, Grip Electric Transpo, welcome to the reality of who carries the power. You don't have your trucks. You don't have your lights. Everybody's got to pack up and go
home. If your star is 2 hours late to set, then there goes your day. So, yeah, that's very interesting.
Oh, nice get, Mr. Booth. Sounds like you've been there.
Well, no, I'm just saying that showed that where I met that Super Bowl champion. I used to hang out with the transportation captain, and I met that Super Bowl guy because we picked him up at the airport. So
that's exactly right.
I was like, hey, I'll go.
If any department... any department drops the ball, the whole thing implodes.
Oh, right, exactly. So with that, we have a nice, perfect 10-minute window here where I would love for you to tell us what you'd like to tell us about this great film that I saw as a journalist that I write for Influx Magazine. I caught it at Dances with Films at the Hollywood and Highland Complex, and it was called For Spacious Sky, and I would just love to turn it over to you from this point.
You just want me to share about what?
Oh, yeah,
Spacious,
just share the film and let us know, or if there's a way we could see it, any more festivals, and also what that story meant for you, because it had that special meaning.
Well, first of all, I want to say that For Spacious Sky is an exquisite short film directed by Coy Middlebrook, and it's based on a true story which Coy experienced, and the film is a story which takes place between three brothers on election day in 2008. And one of the brothers has just been released from prison and is a white supremacist. Another brother is a gay playwright. And the third brother is dealing with a meth and alcoholism addiction. And the three brothers end up in the same car taking the brother who's an addict to rehab on the day of election. And it's the day that Obama is elected, and which is obviously hugely symbolic to the convergence of all three brothers' distinct storylines and the hope for humanity to come together regardless of how different someone's political, spiritual, or societal, racial prejudices one way or another exist. I don't want to give away the whole film here, but it is truly a Valentine to democracy, and the a little bit of a shout out there to freedom of speech and freedom of choice. Coy Middlebrook is a director who I am very honored currently to be producing his first feature film, which is being written by Coy and his creative partner, writing partner, Jonah Bleckman. Jonah was also one of the lead actors in For Spacious Sky. And Jonah and Coy and I have been collaborating on Ballroom. I can't tell you much about it, but it's going to start moving at a much quicker clip. We've been in development for several years now, and the cast is starting to come together, and we're not ready to announce, but the theme of our feature is that there's room on the dance floor for everyone. And although it is ultimately a bromance buddy film and a very different, fun, upbeat spirit in contrast with For Spacious Sky, again, the themes remain consistent: brotherhood and humanity. And my company, a dear friend of mine wrote a piece of marketing text for my company and for Chakra Films that was, the company description included that it was a company that made films that celebrate the adventure of being human and the human beings who celebrate the adventure. And really, really captured it for me. My dear old friend James Fox put that sentence together for me. And I realized in looking collectively at all of the films I've made, they all share the spirit of the underdog emerging. And whether that emergence is considered or classified victorious by one or the other, I will leave the audiences to determine that. But I also just wanted to share, because you and I talked about it yesterday, first of all, for the audience that is listening to this podcast, I just want to acknowledge you Paul for being such a thorough, consummate professional and academic as well, collaborator and creator yourself.
Well, thank you very much. Your
research in preparing for this interview, although we've only hit a handful of the topics, I feel like you're a budding James Lipton in terms of your own passion and curiosity, and I felt so honored by the way that you approached me, and you did fight hard for this interview, and you stayed on me and prepped it, and when we were speaking yesterday, and I really appreciate that, want to thank you, but you had also, you know, given me a heads up that we would wrap the interview up with talking about what's next for me, and I've already touched upon Ballroom with Coy Middlebrook's next feature. And I just wanted to mention that the other main event feature film in my life, my crown jewel, which I'm producing with my producing partner, Jake Gray, who resides up in Portland, Oregon. And we are telling an epic story about Doc Mayberry, who was a pioneering vet, who teamed up with Morgan Berry, who was an exotic animal importer and elephant whisperer. And it is the incredible tales of Doc Mayberry and the baby elephant. The baby elephant would be a very famous living elephant who resides today in the Portland Zoo, an elephant named Packy, who graced the Life magazine cover back in 1962 when Packy had been the first elephant born into captivity. I believe it had been some 40 years or something. It was an incredibly it was a huge event for all of society because it unified man and the animal kingdom and really brought us closer to the exotic, to the wild, to the nature. And Doc Mayberry is just an incredible, incredible story. And we are in development with that and putting that together as quite a vast Pacific Northwest undertaking.
That's excellent. I love it because I went to film school in Vancouver. I love the Pacific Northwest. So that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, it's going to be a Seabiscuit meets Dr. Doolittle meets Indiana Jones.
Oh, I love that. That's a great thing that you're doing, and that's also because we love that we have filmmakers in other states, other parts of the country, that is something that also, too, a lot of people, filmmakers in L.A., sometimes we have to have four different movies. It's a this meets that meets this with a taste of that, and just remember the ending from it'll be like that ending, and it's just because L.A., like many places have their thing, but the thing with Los Angeles that's so interesting is how it just, you can say a line of a movie instead of having a conversation with someone, and they already know what you meant, and you don't need to talk to them for 20 minutes. They're like, oh, okay, they left that on my voicemail. Okay, I got it.
Okay, wait a second. So that brings us around to the very top of the call again. Show me the money.
Exactly. Show me the money. Exactly. So,
you know, the financing of development and production and marketing, obviously, you know, requires visionary people to sign checks. And it is never of interest to me, really, to deal with just straight corporate funding sources where there isn't an individual with passion behind the project, because you have to protect these stories like they're little babies, they're little kids. You have to raise the stories and let the ideas marinate and the characters take their full genetic, you know, formation before they can start interacting with each other. You know, it's such a magical process, but it's also, in addition to that magic, there's a lot of waiting for paint to dry and the patience and stillness.
Oh, exactly.
Faith.
Yeah, no, exactly, the patience. And I'm so sorry that we came to the end so quick. I know that always happens with a great film talk. I did not mean to cut you off. But
no,
I don't want
it's
to...
been a pleasure. I think
yes,
faith and elephants.
So
great note to end on.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Paul. Lots of love.
The name Talking Pictures was created by Alexa Foreman. Web design by Josh Lane. Written and produced by Rob Sterrett, Jim McNulty, and Paul Booth. Post-production by Dustin Lucas.